I want to start off today just by talking about John, the name John. There's a few in this church, aren't there, called John. We often say to people when they first come, when we introduce ourselves, I'm John, but if you forget my name, don't worry, and if you see somebody else, try John, because, you know, there's quite a few Johns in the room. And even if I said John from the Bible, you wouldn't know which John I meant, would you? Because, you know, there's more than one. And I was thinking how much I've been influenced by people named John in my reading and stuff like that. And so, John Wesley is a case in point, who was converted by the Moravians in London. And the Moravians grew out of the teaching of John Huss, of a Czech martyr, was martyred for his faith. His followers were called the Hussites. He didn't say anything that we wouldn't agree with, but he was martyred for that. John Huss was in turn influenced by an Englishman who wanted the Bible translated into English. His name was John Wycliffe. And then, in the Puritan days, there was John Owen, one of the best Puritan writers, and John Bunyan, famous for Pilgrim's Progress, maybe the most read book after the Bible in those days. There used to be three books that people read: the Bible, Pilgrim's Progress, and Fox's Book of Martyrs. I don't know if he was a John Fox, I don't know. But there's another John who's had a big influence on my life. Oh, by the way, I didn't mention John Calvin, and you know, you just go on and on. But there's another John who has a big influence on my life. And his name is John Fletcher. And I have heroes. I don't know if you have Christian heroes. And I don't know if you have people that you thank God for. I do. I thank God a lot. I thank God for that person. People who are alive now. Might be you lot in this room. Well, some of you. You know, but I thank God for, you know, Rick Oldham last week. Thank God for a man of God like that who preaches like people who inspire you. And James L. Adrian, he inspires me, you know, young man of 30, but I find him inspirational. And so often I go through life just thanking God for certain people, that the people in your life who influence you. But for me, I'm a big reader, so it's sometimes it's people who aren't around now who influence me. And as I say, John Fletcher is one of those people. I'm going to mention a few times today in relation to this passage that we're going to look at. I'd never heard of him until 20 years ago. I don't know how many of you have been coming to this church for 20 years or more. Quite a few actually. 1996, we had visitors come from Toronto. One of them was called John Friel. And the two others were Richard Long and Rick Berry. But I had the privilege of driving them round. I went to pick them up in Telford, the three of them, and an old Volvo. I think I'd borrowed it, because it's not a Volvo that was ever in our... I think our car was broke, so we borrowed a Volvo of somebody. Possibly Rob Channing's or something like that. I can't remember. Anyway, I went to Telford to drive these three Canadians around. Just thought, whatever I can get out of these men while they're here. Because in those days, impartation was quite strong. You know, somebody prayed for you in those days. The move of God was so strong, you'd pick something up off them. Still happens. But in those days, it seemed to happen a bit stronger than it does now. It still happens. I felt the touch of God last week, sat there when Rick was speaking. He didn't touch me, but I just felt the Spirit of God. Anyway, I drove them around. I drove them here. They did some meetings here. And then I drove them to Sheffield, where their next meetings were, and showed them Chatsworth and Bakewell. And anyway, when I was talking to them, they mentioned to me, because I'd picked them up in Telford, they said, have you ever heard of Fletcher of Madeley? Has anybody heard of Fletcher of Madeley? It's quite an obscure figure, isn't it? You've heard of Madeley? Yeah? It's a small village, or it was in those days. I think it's just been absorbed by Telford now. In fact, on the last weekend away, we went looking for it, didn't we? Did we find it? Can't remember if we found it. I think we just drove around looking for it. I wanted to see Fletcher's church. So anyway, I'd never heard of him. I said, who's Fletcher of Madeley? And, but they were from Canada, and they knew Fletcher of Madeley. And since then, I've found out a lot about him. He wrote a book called Christ Manifested. It's out of print. You can't get it. It's a very small, thin book. I did manage to get a copy off a friend. Pages are falling out. I've read it 3 times. And anything else I can get hold of that John Fletcher wrote, I get hold of. I went into a charity shop in Clitheroe this year, and I saw this. Wesley's designated successor. And I thought, I know who that is. John Wesley wanted John Fletcher to take over from him when he died. So I thought, wow! You know, I had this thin book at home, pages falling out, read 3 times. That's all I could get hold of, John Fletcher. And then I saw this. It's all about John Fletcher. He wanted a lot for it, for a charity shop, actually. £20. But, you know, I paid. It's an absolute gem for me because he's a hero of mine. One of his biographers was a man called John Benson, Methodist. And he tells the story of John Fletcher going to this college where there were people studying the Bible, Bible students, in the 1700s. Because actually he couldn't become Wesley's designated successor because he died before John Wesley. So he couldn't become his successor. He was a Church of England minister. He was a vicar of Madeley. But he went to this college to lecture to students, and apparently every time he lectured, they were in tears. And they said he looked like an angel. His face was like an angel. And he had you in tears about his love for Jesus. And I love the things he writes. He was around when that last hymn that we sang was written. So he moved to Madeley in 1760 as the vicar. It was a church that wasn't interested really in God. There was a parish church, but there were less than 20 people in it. And they really didn't want to hear any sort of enthusiastic presentation about God at all. And he was very enthusiastic. At this point, he wasn't married. There was nothing to distract him. He just spent all his time in God's presence. Even walking in the countryside, he'd fall on the grass and just pour his heart out to God. And sometimes he'd walk with a friend. His friend said this afterwards. And but he preached a very powerful message. And in his first 2 years, it was quite condemnatory of the way they lived their lives in the parish. Guess what? They didn't like his preaching. He told them how terrible their lives were, and they didn't like it. In those days, there was fashions around. It was a sort of fashionable Christianity. You know, it was fashionable for some people to go to church, but just keep it there. Don't get excited about it. Keep it under wraps. Show a modicum of decorum. And let it not spill over into the rest of your life. Don't talk about it on any other days, please. And that was the way people viewed it, if they went to church. Most of them didn't go to church. Popular in those days was cock fighting, bull baiting, and things like that. Pardon?
Badgers.
Badger baiting, right. Anyway, once they baited a bull and took it to John Fletcher's house to attack him. But for some reason he didn't go back to his house that day. He went for a walk, and so he was okay. God looked after him. One man came to his church because a friend of his had died, but he wouldn't come into the church. He came to the funeral, but he wouldn't come into the church. John Fletcher said, why aren't you coming into the church? He said, I'll never come into the church while you're the minister. With your holiness and your enthusiasm and your condemning us all the time, I'll never come into your church. Guess what Fletcher said to him? I'm not sure I would ever say this to anybody. He said to him, next time you come into church, you'll be kept being carried in on somebody's shoulders. Oof. This man was 24. A week later, he dropped dead. And was brought into the church. In a coffin, of course. Sometimes God backs up what his people say. Frightening, isn't it? Get yourself right with God, because if you don't, pretty soon you might be being carried into a church on somebody's shoulders. That's the way he preached. A lot of people didn't like it. Anyway, I'm leading up to my story, and then I'll get into the Bible, don't worry. One day, Fletcher's going up to preach in his pulpit, and for the first time ever, he felt he couldn't preach what he'd prepared. Prepared a sermon, but he felt, I can't preach this today. In fact, he felt, I can't preach anything. I'm just going to go up and say, I'm not preaching today, and go back and sit down and close the service. But then as he thought that, he felt God say to him, preach on the fiery furnace in the book of Daniel. So he went up, he said, I'm changing my sermon. I'm going to preach about the fiery furnace in the book of Daniel. And he spoke about it. Shadrach, Meshach, Abednego. Finished up, said, do not fear the fiery furnace, because God will preserve you. Do not fear the fiery furnace. God will preserve you. No matter what you're facing, whether it's like a fiery furnace, God will preserve you. Unknown to John Fletcher, there was a woman in the village who attended his church, and her husband didn't like her attending the church. He was very angry. And you're not going to that church. She said, I have to go. I just love hearing about Jesus. I just have to go to that church. He says, if you go to that church, I'll cut your throat when you come home. And she panicked. But she thought, I'm still going to the church. Anyway, this is in the middle of the week. On the Sunday she gets up to go. He says, I won't cut your throat. I'm going to put the oven on to its greatest heat, and I'm going to throw you in the oven. I'm going to throw you in the fiery furnace. She goes to church. Fletcher preaches on the fire, changes his message, the only time he ever changed his message. After the sermon, he doesn't know about her, doesn't know the situation at all. After the sermon, she goes home. She can see flames in her house through the windows. He'd got the oven, so I don't know what kind of oven it was, but he's got it so on fire that she can see the flames. She thinks, that's where I'm going, but I don't care. I just love Jesus, and he'll be with me, whatever happens. And she goes in, and the man's on his knees crying. Forgive me, he says. Forgive me, I'm not going to do this. And I've been so wrong. Forgive me, he says. I'm going to start coming to church with you. That's just a story I want you to tell. Because you see, God speaks into two people's lives on the same day. He speaks to John Fletcher. And he speaks into the situation in that house. And he sees them both. And everything about it. The man changing the threat. And the specificness of the threat. And the specificness of Fletcher's message that day. I'm telling that story because it's the words that Jesus speaks are what we are to follow today. He speaks to us, and we're to listen. My sheep hear my voice, he says. John chapter 10. My sheep hear my voice, and they follow me. She heard Jesus' voice. Fletcher heard Jesus' voice. She didn't die, and her husband was saved. I thought it would be a great story to lead into this, because Jesus here talks about the bread of life. He talks about the bread that we eat. And then he says, but the real bread is what I give to you spiritually. The things I say to you. So let's read again, John chapter 6. From verse 25 this time. And he fed the 5,000. Now they found him, verse 25, when they found him on the other side of the lake, John 6:25, when they found him on the other side of the lake, they asked him, "Rabbi, when did you get here?" Jesus says, "I'll tell you the truth. You're looking for me not because you saw miraculous signs, but because you ate the loaves and had your fill. Do not work for food that spoils, but for food that endures to eternal life, which the Son of Man will give you. On him, God the Father has placed his seal of approval." Then they asked him, "What must we do to do the works God requires?" Jesus answered, "The work of God is this, to believe in the one he has sent." So they asked him, "What miraculous sign then will you give that we may see it and believe you? What will you do? Our forefathers ate the manna in the desert, as it is written. He gave them bread from heaven to eat." Jesus said to them, "I tell you the truth. It is not Moses who's given you the bread from heaven, but it's my Father who gives you the true bread from heaven. For the bread of God is he who comes down from heaven and gives life to the world." "Sir," they said, "from now on, give us this bread." And then is Jesus' great statement, verse 35. And Jesus declared, "I am the bread of life. He who comes to me will never go hungry, and he who believes in me will never be thirsty. But as I told you, you have seen me and still you do not believe. All that the Father gives me will come to me, and whoever comes to me, I will never drive away. For I've come down from heaven not to do my will, but to do the will of him who sent me. And this is the will of him who sent me, that I shall lose none of all that he's given me, but raise them up at the last day. For my Father's will is that everyone who looks to the Son and believes in him shall have eternal life, and I will raise him up at the last day." Well, it's a great passage. And the passage revolves around four questions that get asked by those who are following him, the Jews. Verse 25. They find him on the other side of the lake and they asked him, "Jesus, Rabbi, when did you get here?" So that's the first question. Remember, he's walked on the water. That's how he's got there. But you know, Jesus doesn't really answer that question, does he? Look at verse 26. "I tell you the truth. You're looking for me not because you saw miraculous signs, but because you ate the loaves and had your fill. Do not work for the food that spoils, but for food that endures to eternal life, which the Son of Man will give you. On him, God the Father has placed his seal of approval." Then they go on to the second question. But let's deal with this first question. "Rabbi, when did you get here?" The question he doesn't answer. Why doesn't he answer it? Why doesn't he say, "Well, I walked across the water just a few minutes ago"? Doesn't answer it because he knows really what they're thinking, doesn't he? But Jesus knows what you think. And that's really what he's interested in, more than what you say. You can say things, but, you know, people can say things, but Jesus knows what you think. So he knows what they're thinking. Not really asking how he got there. They want to know more about him. They want to probe him. But Jesus lays bare their motives. "I tell you the truth, you're looking for me, not because you saw a miraculous sign, but because you ate the loaves and had your fill." What he's saying is, you're looking for me for what I can give you. You're looking for me for material means. I don't know, you know, when you became a Christian, whether that entered into your thinking in any way. If I become a Christian, will I benefit in some way, materially? You know, will Jesus stop me being ill? Will he stop me being poor? Will he sort out my relationships? Things he might do for me. Is there anything wrong in wanting him to do those things? No. Is there anything wrong in people eating bread? No. But Jesus is cutting through what they've asked and saying, what you really, you just want the physical bread. You're not really following me for the spiritual bread. Bread's a great emblem of something, isn't it? Think about the emblems in the Bible and what they represent. I mean, the emblems are all good. What's water? What does water represent? You know, when you think of water, what does water represent? Any ideas? Life? Yeah? Sorry? Spirit? Refreshment? Washing? Can't survive without it, can you? Water. People make settlements where there's water. Towns and cities grow up around rivers. Springs. Military sieges don't last long if there's no water. If there's water inside the city walls, they can hang out there a long time. Water is symbolic. It's a good thing and it's symbolic of all of the things we just said. What about honey? The Bible mentions honey, doesn't it? The word is like honey. What's honey symbolic of? Joy, yeah. Anything else? What's it taste like?
Sweet.
Sweet. Your words are like honey to me. They're sweet. They drip like honey. They're sweet to my taste. How about jewels? When Jesus talked about building the temple, God talked about building the temple. Build it with sapphires. Build it with amethysts. Build it with agate. And why? Why make a building with jewels? Any ideas? Simple answer. Beauty. Beauty, yeah. Beauty, gracious. And then Jesus said, you're the temple. Get beauty into your life. Get beauty into your spirit. God likes beauty. I like beautiful things. Get sweetness into your spirit. Get flowing water into your spirit. Get beauty into your spirit. Oil? Well, bread. Bread symbolic of what? What does bread do? Physical bread, I mean. What does it do? Feeds you. Sustains you. Good word. Nourishes. Staple diet, isn't it, for a lot of countries? And so Jesus says, when you pray, say, give us this day our daily bread. We need it, don't we? Some countries it might be different, staple diet. Remember the Chernobyl kids? They loved bread, didn't they? Bread and cabbage. Because it was staple to them. They just had bread. They put rolls on the table. They'd all go, you know. Bread. Jesus said, I'm the bread of life. And he's answering the question. He's answering what their thoughts are rather than their question. And he's saying, I'm the bread of life. This is what you need to look for. Not the bread that spoils. I can give you physical bread. I gave you some yesterday. You'll need it again today. But that perishes. But why don't you get the bread of life into your life? Why don't you get the thing that nourishes your spirit, satisfies your spirit, feeds your spirit into your life? When you become a Christian, that's what happens, isn't it? That's what he starts to do. If you feed on him, that is. There are many distractions, aren't there, in life that stop us from feeding on him. I was looking at a man called Alexander McLaren. His name's not John, but he's a good preacher. He preached in Manchester Church of 2000 in those days, up near where the MRI is now, near the university, in the 1870s, 100 years after John Fletcher. Alexander McLaren, Scottish man, but a great preacher. They knew about him in America. They called him McLaren of Manchester. He used to want to get hold of his published sermons. Anyways, you can read his published sermons. You can go and start for the local history library. Get McLaren's sermons out. And you can get them online as well. You can read them online, free. And he did a series on John's Gospel. He did one on this passage. And he said about this particular section here, he's dissecting their motives. He's laying them bare. And not only about them, but it's about most of the people you meet every day. Their motives. Their motives are basically material. They're basically things they can see, perceived needs. They don't see spiritual needs. They might feel empty. They might feel depressed. They might feel low, but they don't tie it up with what Jesus is offering. And so he said this, and this is a great statement. I've made it bold in my notes. There's a fatal predominance of earthly tastes and appetites, which dulls perception of and desire after higher good. Just read it again. There's a fatal predominance of earthly tastes and appetites, which dulls perception of and desire after higher good. And the things that we think about on a daily basis actually dull our perception of God and our desire of God. So, if you're like me, like I prayed this morning, I don't wake up thinking about God straight away. I don't wake up thinking, "Ah, I've woke." Dive out of bed onto my knees and start thinking about God. I don't do that. It doesn't come natural to me. Probably does to you lot, but I'm less, you know, holy than you guys. And I have to actually physically, determinedly turn to God if I want something in my life from him that day. Otherwise, what comes into my life when I get up? The news? First thing I hear? Breakfast? Well, nothing wrong with breakfast, right? But, you know, things that will take away your taste for God and your desire for God just come to you without you trying. Don't they? Adverts. Driving along. Walking along. All kinds of things hit you, bombard you. They're not spiritual. The BBC is not spiritual, I'm afraid. Its founder was Lord Reith. He was a very spiritual man. But it's not spiritual anymore. Your newspapers. We don't get a newspaper, but next door push a paper through a day late because they've no blue bin. So we see the paper a day late and the headlines are, you know, not usually all that uplifting. Storm, such a thing coming, we're all doomed. It's going to hit you next week, this, you know. And yeah. New killer bug on its way. Possible cure for such thing. Ah, some good news. Don't eat this. What? This is causing this. What? Last week you said it was such a thing. Every week, every week, at least once a week, there's something about don't eat something. It's the possible cause of something. That paper to me, I think it should just be channeled right from the front door into the blue bin. It sometimes ends up in the kitchen and you see the headlines. So there's things hit us every day without us even trying that are not conducive to your spiritual walk. They're not conducive to your spiritual taste, your spiritual desire. And that's what Alexander McLaren's statement said. It said again, I'll just repeat it once more, there's a fatal predominance of earthly tastes and appetites which dulls perception of and desire after higher good. And that was before, you know, electronic stuff, wasn't it? That's before the internet, it's before films, it's before... But, you know, some of those films, they're so well done, aren't they, you know? And you sit there and you're gripped, you're on the edge of your seat, you know, and then... You know, I enjoy it. I get hooked. I've got what's in the next episode, you know. But But it's not really done my spirit much good. It was 2 hours of real enjoyment and distraction, and so well produced, and the photography was fantastic, and the acting was amazing. And, you know, and I'm not saying we should never relax, but let's be aware that certain things pull us away from spirituality. So it's not just true about the people that Jesus is talking to, it's true about the people we mix with, and it's true about our neighbours, and it's true about our family members, contacts we have, and us as well. I mean, how would you fare if you asked yourself certain questions on a daily basis? Let me tell you 12 questions that John Fletcher used to ask himself every day. I think you'd be getting behind your seats when you hear these. You'd be hiding. He asked himself these things every day, sort of self-examination. 12 questions. Oh, now, I wonder if you ever asked yourself these things. Did I awake spiritual? And was I watchful in keeping my mind from wandering this morning when I rose? That's question one. Oh, I already told you. I failed that one straight away. Number two, have I this day got nearer to God in times of prayer? Or have I given way to a lazy, idle spirit? Ouch! Number three, has my faith been weakened by unwatchfulness or quickened by diligence this day? Number four, have I this day walked by faith and eyed God in everything? Number five, have I denied myself in all unkind words and thoughts to other people or towards other people? Have I delighted in seeing others preferred before me? Number six, have I made the most of my precious time as far as I had light, strength and opportunity? Number seven, have I kept the issues of my heart in the means of grace so as to profit by them? That's number seven. How's your score at the moment? How many no's are you clocking up? Don't answer. Number eight, what have I done this day for the souls and bodies of God's dear saints? Number nine, have I laid out anything to please myself when I might have saved the money for the cause of God? Number ten, have I governed well my tongue this day? Remembering that in a multitude of words there wanteth not sin. And number 11, in how many instances have I denied myself this day? And lastly, number 12, do my life and conversation adorn the gospel of Jesus Christ? By the way, conversation in those days meant behavior. Do my life and behavior adorn the gospel of Jesus Christ? Well, those sort of questions to me make me think I don't take my faith as seriously as he did. I don't take my faith as seriously as the men of God of the past did. And I wonder whether you know, that is indicative of spirituality in Britain. We don't take our faith that seriously, do we? Does it bother us that much, those questions? I told you you might want to hide behind the seat. Because then he went on, he says these are the questions he asked his parishioners. There's even more here. Do I feel any pride? Am I dead to desire of praise? If any despise me, do I like them the worse for it? Or if they love me, do I approve them? Do I love them more on that account? Is Christ the life of all my affections and designs, as my soul is the life of my body? Have I always the presence of God? And so on. I'm not even a quarter of the way through. I'll stop there because I'm sure you've got a few no's to those questions. So back to the passage. You didn't look for me for the real bread. You looked for me for the physical bread. Verse 27, don't work for the food that spoils, but for food that endures to eternal life, which the Son of Man will give you. On him, God the Father has placed his seal of approval. So then they come back with the second question, verse 28. And I've got to move quickly through now. Verse 28, they asked him, what must we do to do the works God requires? Verse 28. What must we do? Interesting what Jesus answers. Verse 29, Jesus' answer. This is a very short conversation. What must we do? Verse 29, the work of God is this. To believe in the one he has sent. They want to know, okay, what do we do? And he says, what your work is to believe. But if you want to do things, believing is not enough, is it? Well, okay, I do believe, but what do you want me to do? But to Jesus, this is the key thing. What do you believe? You know, belief governs the way you live, doesn't it? Belief governs your lifestyle. It governs how you direct your thoughts, what you think about. And what you put your energy into, what you put your efforts into. They're all based on what you believe. I was talking the other week to Joe Armstrong. He's not here, is he? We talked about sport. We talked about honesty in sport. When we were young, I know men of my age are always talking about when we were young, you know, but it's true. When we were young, there was honesty in sport. You remember this, right? Particularly in cricket. You know, the fast bowler comes up. There's a thin edge off your bat that only you heard. And it gets caught behind. You're out, aren't you? You've nicked a catch, but nobody heard the nick. But in those days, bat under the arm, off they go. I was out. I nicked it. That stopped when a sort of philosophy came around that don't be so stupid, don't give yourself out. Wait till if the umpire didn't see you, you're not out, mate. Well, you are, aren't you? Oh, no, it wasn't a clean catch. I didn't catch it. And football, too. I remember, you know, when I played football, we used to say, it's your throw. Well, that went off me, it's a corner for you. That's what people used to say. And now we have the professional foul. Pull him down. Otherwise, your manager will not be pleased with you. But that's cheating. Pull him down or you're not in my team. That's dishonesty, isn't it, in sport? What you believe affects how you behave. I've got to pull him down because he might go through, and it's more important that I stop him going through than that we play fair. Happens in other walks of life too. What you believe affects the way you behave. What about courtesy? If you believe it's good to be courteous. Now, courtesy doesn't actually do anything, does it? Doesn't benefit you really. Being courteous, good manners, is because of a belief system. So, and I've told this story before, but I know you wouldn't all have been here when I've told it. I've told it a few times, so apologies to those who've heard it. I went to Israel with a group from this church. Peter Bright, remember Peter Bright? Peter Bright came and we were stood in a hotel lobby in a hotel in, I think it was Tiberias. And he said, I'm just going up to my room. So he goes to the lift, stands there waiting for the lift. Nobody else waiting with him. The lift comes down, doors open. People appear from nowhere, from behind him. They were sat down, there had been the seats. The lift's full, the door's closed, and he's like this. And then the guide said, we're going to get on a bus and go to this kibbutz. So we'll wait here for the bus. So I said, which end is the queue? Well, don't worry about the queue. I said, well, how do we get on? Well, use your elbows, they said. So, and then I said, I want to go to a country, I don't know the language, I'd like to learn a few words, please, thank you, hello, goodbye. I said, how do you say please and thank you in Hebrew? You won't need those. He said, they just don't say it, they just don't say it. So, what you believe governs what you, the way you behave. English people queue. Or wait in line, as the Americans call it, don't we? We queue. People think it's peculiar about us that we queue. It's based on what you believe, or what we used to believe. What about prayer? Well, if you believe prayer achieves things, then you will pray, won't you? What if you believe prayer doesn't do anything? What if you believe, you know, come to prayer meeting, there's only two of us there? How's this going to achieve anything? Well, it depends what you believe, doesn't it? If you believe that you praying to God has an effect, then it doesn't matter how many is there, does it? You're praying to God. God, I believe, God is determined to cooperate with people on earth, to work with them. He wants you to ask him things. He wants to do that, but he wants you to ask him. Don't know why, but that's the way God is. If you believe prayer is no good, then you won't pray. If you believe it does something, then you will pray. On this point of Jesus saying, believe, that's his answer. He does say a bit more, doesn't he? Verse 29, the work of God is this, to believe in the one he sent. Because another sort of modern day mantra that you hear on chat shows, it doesn't matter what you believe as long as you are sincere. That is absolute tosh, isn't it? And you hear it all the time, chat shows, interviews. Well, as long as you're sincere about that, as long as that's real to you, that is very important. Nonsense. Doesn't make it right because you think it's right. You know, this can't be right. I don't believe God would do this because God... Well, is he like that? Is that what the Bible says like that? The only thing we know about God is what the Bible tells us about him and what creation tells us about him. But the greatest revelation of God is the Bible. If we want to know what he's like, what has he revealed to us? It's no good me saying, I think God's like this. What do you think he's like? Well, I think he's not like you, so I think he's like this. But what's he said he's like? And Jesus said, he who has seen me has seen the Father. God is like Jesus. So he says, believe in the one he sent. In other words, believe in me. Okay, I better wind up to a conclusion. They come back and ask another question. What miraculous sign will he give us? Verse 30. Typical Jewish question. Do us a miracle. Herod asked Jesus when he was arrested. Do us a miracle. Perform a sign for us. Jesus didn't, did he? He said to him on the cross, if you're the Son of God, get yourself down. Do a miracle. The devil said to him, if you're the Son of God, jump off the cliff. The angels will catch you. Do a sign. Jesus doesn't respond in that way, does he? He doesn't respond to those kind of requests. He does do signs and miracles, but not in response to those kind of questions. And the miracle isn't the main thing to Jesus. For you and me, what does this mean? It means don't let us base our walk with God on what he can do for us. Don't fall out with God because he didn't provide this for you. Because he didn't sort that out for you. Because he didn't provide, you know, the funds. Or even, he didn't take away your illness. But you don't fall out with God because of that. Jesus said, I will preserve your going out and your coming in. Those whom God gives me will never be lost. They will never be cast out. Jesus says, give me your soul. Give me your spirit. Believe in the one that God has sent. And I will look after your soul for eternity. Forever. Death will not end my looking after your soul. Don't fear death. Because there's a lot more after death. As Mike Bickle often says, you know, the moment you die, you get into God's presence immediately and you say, boy, did I get the deal. You know, you're translated from this earthly life into, wow, jewels, beauty, colour, worship, people you used to know who love God, people you didn't used to know who love God, angels, no sin, no sickness, no trials, no frustrations, no getting tired, no getting bored. We get bored because our brains are, you know, dysfunctional, aren't they? They don't work in an eternal way. We're going to get new bodies, new brains. We'll be always interested and fascinated by things. Don't you have spells in your life when you just can't get enough knowledge? I do. I just get spells like, oh, I've got to find this out, I've got to find that. I've got a bit like that all the time. Knowledge. Woo! Go over there, John. You can have a chat with Lord Nelson. He's over there. Okay, let's conclude. Jesus said, I'm the bread of life. He fills the hungry with good things, Mary prayed in the Magnificat. The psalmist said, oh, taste and see that the Lord is good. Eat spiritually. Taste spiritual food. And that's what he's talking about here. Taste and see that the Lord is good. My conclusion is this. To urge you to be vigilant in watching the trends that would pull you away from God. Watching the trends that would take your spirit and your energies away from God. Subtle things and obvious things. Things that are sent to divert you. Work out your own salvation with fear and trembling, it says in the Bible. You need to work. You need to position yourself before God. What is the work? To believe in the one who God has sent. So, Jesus said, I'm the bread of life. Whoever comes to me will never go hungry. Whoever believes in me will never be thirsty. Amen. Thank you for listening.